Where is home? Is home a place or is home a feeling? It's hard to say, but I think it's a mix of both. But this world is so vast, and we need to explore and soak up as much of it as we can while we're here on this earth. Today's guest has moved all around, but through all of it, has used her art to stay grounded and to find her way home once again. Strap in, everyone, because not only is today's episode extremely inspiring, but it's also very fun. I'm your host, Jacob Johnson. This is the My Art is Real podcast, a narrative journey into the lives that shape art. Today's episode, Rachel Pease, right after the break. This show is fully produced by me, Jacob. So if you would like to see it grow, you can do so by simply sharing it with everyone you think would enjoy it. On top of that, if you want to take that support a step further, you can head on over to our website, myartisreal.com, and collect limited edition art prints made in studio by me with previous guests and other art friends. We also have a Patreon page, which will be overflowing with more content soon, where you can support us for as little as $3 a month and receive plenty of extra benefits. Okay, back to the episode.
My name is Rachel Pease. I'm an artist. I work in ink on this kind of synthetic paper, and I'm a landscape artist, so I do these sort of surreal landscapes, both a microscopic detail and a monumental feel to them. Currently based in the UK, but I'm originally from the United States.
Like me, Rachel grew up in a small town where the most fun thing to do was to just run around and play in the woods.
I grew up in Indiana, and the sort of community I grew up in was a farming community, and I sort of had that wild freedom growing up, so I don't really remember much adult supervision. Most of the adults I do remember when I was younger, it was because I was either getting in trouble or they wanted us to entertain them. But it was sort of one of those things. I was let out the door in the morning, and then, you know, you just come home by dinner time and you eat food. And it was really nice.
Growing up in a farming town, Rachel was always really into animals. She even had her own horse and, believe it or not, won a pet pig. I'd say it's safe to say she definitely grew up in the country.
You know, I was really into animals. I mentioned I had a horse, but I also got a pig because I won this pig wrestling contest. So this was also something, again, I should phrase that. It was in the 80s, and I feel like the sort of animal rights that we know now just didn't exist. And I remember my mother and her friend, I think they signed me up for the competition. I did not want to do it. And what they do is they put you in a pen with like a pig, and it's a muddy pen, and it's like in a stadium. So you have all these like fans cheering for you. And they put like oil on the pig and oil on your arms. And the first person to get the pig from one area into a pen wins one of the pig's babies. So I remember and not wanting to do it. But, you know, I was like, okay, this isn't going to end until like someone gets the pig in the pen. So I think I was really determined at that point because I was a super shy kid and I hated being kind of in front of people. Somehow I was the youngest, but I ended up getting the pig into the pen. I was like, oh, okay, that's over with. And I got kind of excited that I would have a pet pig after that. But then the next day I like woke up and my parents were really excited and I was on the front page of the local paper. So then the next day, like just random people I would see on the street would walk up to me and congratulate me. And it was so awful. I wanted to melt.
Rachel, the local pig catcher. What a title.
And then I think it was school the next year, and it was like fourth grade or something. And I was really excited because I heard the fourth grade teacher was super cool. And like the first day of class, I walk in, and my teacher's like, we have a celebrity among us. And he like brought the paper in from the summer. So it was like this thing that never ended.
Rachel really did not want to be known for being the pig catcher. No, she'd rather be known for her creativity.
So after that, I was like, this cannot be my like road to fame. And I started, along with the pig, I won some art materials, or not art materials, money, which I bought my first art materials with. And I decided to start entering art competitions at the like 4-H fair, the county fair. And so I started like competing, doing art stuff quite young too.
Art and being creative wasn't a large part the backbone of her childhood. Being in a small town, you have to find any way you can to entertain yourself. And drawing was definitely one way that Rachel could do that.
Yeah, I always loved art growing up. My mother's friend who she lived with actually taught me how to draw. And she was a tough teacher. I remember there was many times she would sit me down and if I didn't draw something to her satisfaction, I couldn't like get up. So there was one time I remember I had to draw some like flower from outside. It was kind of like a carnation type of flower that didn't have much form to it. And I think she made me sit there for like 2 hours because she was like, "You're not even looking at it." And I had to redraw it like over and over again. And I remember hearing all these other kids playing outside and just like really wanting to go join them. But I finally did it somehow to her satisfaction. And it looked like the flower. And I think since then, it kind of built a sort of discipline in me. And I know I can sort of create or draw anything that I put my mind to.
Did you enjoy those lessons at all? Or did you just want to get it over with and go out and play?
No, I really enjoyed drawing. And I always loved painting and doing all sorts of art sort of things. But I think it's different when, since they were like lessons, I had to draw stuff that I think was like beyond my ability at the time, you know? So that was quite tough, but you know, it felt good if I could get through it. But yeah, I love drawing. You know, I always was drawing. And I think even in school, I could always draw like cartoon characters like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and stuff like that. So everyone always, I think I got a lot of praise for it when I was younger from my peers and adults because I was good at it.
And these art contests, what exactly were they like? I know you said you won some of them.
The first competitions I did, since we're a small town, like the county fair each summer is like really big and they have something called 4-H where you could compete in, you know, someone might show their cow or an animal or some vegetable they grew in the garden. But then they have other stuff that you can compete in, like drawing and painting and baking. And then whoever wins goes to like the state fair. And you can compete in that from a very young age. So I would just submit those drawings each year or a painting. And if you win, like get a like reserve champion or a grand champion, stuff like that, you get money as well. I started eventually winning like grand champion each year, and then you get money from that.
While her family was very creative, they focused more on science rather than art.
My family is kind of like doctors, nurses, engineers, chemists, like I have a very science-oriented family. So yeah, that was more like what I was surrounded by when I grew up.
Her grandpa specifically was very full of curiosity and always engineering these very interesting little contraptions.
I mean, I loved science. My grandfather in particular was very curious and he had a lot of curiosity and he was very inventive and it was always fun to be around him. Like we would, you know, like magnetize an anvil by running electricity through it, or he would, you know, like do little experiments where things bubbled or boiled. And, you know, I remember him bringing like a jar of mercury one time and to my school for Grandparents' Day. And there was like a glove you could stick your hand in and you could touch the mercury. And they just passed it around the classroom. Like it wasn't a big thing. And he would like wire his whole house. So like these little light bulbs. And so say like the mail got delivered, a light above the fireplace would come on and you could get into the house without keys, but with magnets, you know, if you touched a magnet to certain bolts around the house, like it would open a door. So for me, it always just seemed really fun because he made it fun. But, you know, like later when I was in college, I was like, this isn't as fun as I thought it'd be.
Of course, as she got older, the town started to be even less fun. She was itching to leave and head off to college.
Oh, no, definitely. I think the high school years, I was like, oh, I can't wait to get out of here. And I moved out of my house when I was 17. And, you know, it was like light a match and throw it behind my shoulder and don't look back sort of thing. Yeah, there wasn't really much to do. Sometimes we would drive to like Indianapolis, the city or something like that. You know, for me, like high school was the late 90s. So there was a lot of like raves or punk bands or rock bands or stuff like that up in the city. So sometimes we go and see that sort of stuff. But yeah, our town was completely dead. And they even had a curfew. So I think you had to have a note from your parent if you were out past 10 o'clock.
When it came time to decide what she was going to do for school, well, she went with science like her family did before her.
I mean, like, I made art, but I just saw people around me doing art as a hobby. I never even thought outside of like maybe a comic book artist that that could be a job. So I always took art classes in school, which all the art teachers were horrible, I think, at my school. Yeah, so I took a lot of science, like chemistry, biology, physics in school. And that was the realm I was in.
People do that a lot, right? They tend to go to school for something that maybe their parents encourage them to do or something that they do have a knack for and that's supposed to pay well. Rachel decided to go to school for chemistry. She was really great at it. But even if you're great at something, should you keep doing it if your heart is not in it?
I think what happened, I remember being in the lab one day and just everyone being really into what they were doing. And I realized that I just wasn't. You know, I did it for three years, I think, how long I studied the science before I made this switch. So it was quite a long time. And I just didn't have a passion for it. I realized after that long, I was just good at it, but I didn't love it in the way that people were excited about pursuing their experiments or these sorts of things. I just didn't have that.
So she switched to art.
And then I eventually transferred to Indiana University. It's more like a liberal arts school, so I was still in state at the time. But the school that I went to, I eventually landed in the painting program. And I felt like it was a very traditional school, like you work from models and you're painting with oil paints and a lot of observational sort of work. I don't think they even have a painting program now, but at the time they had like a pretty hefty BFA and MFA program. So there would be like 40 painters, and we had like this old dormitory for studios. So it was like, everyone had these giant studios. It was pretty crazy. So that was really nice.
How did your family take that switch? Were they supportive?
I think when I changed to art, like, because I started out studying science. And then when I took some art classes at college, I realized that that could be a thing people do. And then when I changed to art, I think it was more of an issue. My dad doesn't really give his opinion that often, but I think it was upsetting for my mom because she's a nurse, and it was really hard, she said, for her to get her like nursing degree. Like, she had to work really hard to do it, and she saw me doing science and it came quite easy. I think it was a little upsetting for her to see that I could do this thing well that she worked so hard to be able to do. And then when I switched to art, she was just like, how are you going to eat? Like, how are you going to, you know, all of these like concerns with parents, she just didn't see how it was like a viable path. But I think, you know, once she's kind of seen what I've created, I mean, it's not like an issue with them anymore. but they were definitely worried.
Of course, everyone would be worried about their kids going to art school. It's a super unstable career path, but life is short. And if your heart tells you to make art, well, you better listen to it and take that leap before you regret it. And I mean, can you recall that moment for you where you realized that art was more than just, you know, some little designs or some comics?
I don't think there was one moment. I mean, it kind of came on gradually. I think a little bit of it I mentioned before is like I didn't really have much exposure to art. So like I just thought I drew as a hobby. I think the first time I saw a museum was when I was 15. And I remember I saw like a James Turrell piece and I was just floored. It was like a room. It just looked like there was a gray painting on the wall. And I think I was there on a school trip with a bunch of kids and we were just messing around, to be honest. And I think we went up to the painting and, you know, like me being, I mean, I feel horrible saying this now, but just that mischievous teen. I think I went up to the painting to like flick it or touch it or something like that. I was like, oh, it's a gray painting. Let me touch it. And my hand went through the painting. And then I realized it wasn't a painting. It was like kind of an optical illusion, and that there was really an entire expansive room that was even bigger than the one that we were in behind it. I think it was at that point I realized the sort of transformative nature of art and materials. And it really blew my mind. And I remember sitting, like visiting the museum later and just sitting in that room and watching people's reactions as they came up to this gray painting. Cause some people would be so mad about it. You know, they would be like, why is this in a room by itself? And, you know, I'm like, oh, just walk a little closer. And then, you know, people just being shocked.
The more and more Rachel thought about it, she began to uncover more previous moments in her life where she started to see art in the world. There was this one moment specifically where she was young and did a photograph series, which I will call the Roadkill Project.
I guess there was just never one moment, you know, because I can think even when I was little doing these like art projects, like, I mean, when I was really little, I had this like Roadkill Project that I did. I had like one of those cameras that used to be like the 12 or the 24 photos was all you could take. And I would ride around on my bike. And I remember seeing like flattened roadkill one time in the road. And I was just so fascinated again with this transformation of how this thing could be like this living thing and then flattened and be this completely other thing. And I was quite young, probably like 7. And I took all these photos because again, I guess I played in the road all the time. And I made them, I like begged my mom to develop them. And I made them into this like, cut them to these beautiful sizes and put them in this, I think it was like a plush pink wallet. But back in the day, they used to have like photo inserts. So I thought it made it look like really beautiful. And I was so excited. And I couldn't wait to show my family these. And I think I showed my parents and they were like, they were smiling so much and they were so like laughing. And I thought they were so proud of me. And then I think later, a party where my mom and parents had friends over and they were like, Rachel, go get it. And I was like, oh, they love this so much. They want to show all their friends. And I was showing it to them. And then I realized everyone was like laughing, but not laughing because they were happy that I made this thing. They were like laughing at me. And I was so devastated. I remember like going to my bedroom and like hiding it and like crying. But I guess my whole point of the story is I've always had this fascination with what I see in the natural world. And I've always had this desire to like capture something. For me, art wasn't born at one moment or my desire to pursue it. It just was there and it kind of grew in different ways. So when I was younger, I would do this or exposed to different art at different times. Okay, now I'm getting super rambly.
What I love so much about that story is if you take the Roadkill Project and you place it in a different environment, it comes across very differently. If you took all of these photos of Roadkill that she had and you framed them and hung them in a museum or a gallery, it becomes a statement and it could even represent 100 different things. Like you could even say it's a study of the American back roads. But when it's these photos taken by a child and placed in a pink wallet full of photo slots, it can seem pretty weird. But it shows that even from a young age, Rachel was seeing the beauty in the mundane and had a knack for finding these bizarre, beautiful aspects of this world we live in. And actually, Rachel has another photo series project to tell us about.
I had this like other series of photos that I was really proud of, too. I was really into taking photographs of people as they opened doors. So like if someone came into the house, you know, I knew a guest was coming over, I'd wait by the door. And the second they opened the door, I'd snap a photo. And it was great because they were always smiling and there was always this like dynamism to it. But then my other photos I wanted to take were of knocking on doors when you were like inside the house and people are doing like their thing, like your sister's in your bedroom or your dad's like working in his room or something. And you knock on the door and they open the door and then you snap like a quick photo. And oh my God, it's the complete opposite. It was like angry, annoyed, slamming doors in faces, or like, what? Why are you taking a photo of me? I don't know. It was so funny. I loved that series I did too.
Once in art school, she started to see more and more examples of people making a living from art. From people working in advertising, selling their own works, or even teaching the arts to the younger generations. And once you see that something that you want to do can be done, you start to feel more confident. A fire starts to burn inside you, and it drives you to chase those dreams even harder. Luckily for Rachel, she had also had a great professor that left a huge mark on her and helped her become inspired.
I was about to say, like, I did have this one really amazing teacher when I was in college, in my undergrad. His name was Barry Gilt, and he taught like an advanced drawing course to BFA students. And I met him, I went on an overseas program, like had gotten a grant to go on an overseas program to study in Florence. We got along right away. He was like this old billy goat of a man, but super charming. It was just strange because I've never been so close of friends with someone so much older than me. Like, we still chat on the phone to this day and keep in touch. Just the way he taught was like throwing everything at you. You know, he was like passionate about the art that we saw, and he'd be like, okay, we're just going to draw from like the Boboli Gardens today. And I want to see if you can get like all the way up to the sky, to down to the bottom and to the right and to the left, and see how much you can put in there. And like, you know, he just like really pushed you to have these expansive views, which was already sort of things I was doing in my art. And he had these different ideas of like combining perspectives, like literal and emotional perspectives. So you could look at a thing from the top and the bottom, think and imagine the other side, and also imagine being the thing. So he was really, I think, influential to the way I think about art. And we would just have wonderful conversations, and he was just so encouraging. And through my whole undergraduate career, he really advocated not only for me, but the other students. So he would make like the entire program apply for these creative activities grants, or write these proposals. And we were able to do like trips to France to see Monet's gardens and go to Normandy and visit Van Gogh's grave and do some really wild things. I think for me, like traveling the world, because I was able to go to Italy and Spain and France with sort of this kind of support that in England too, I was able to see just so much art. It was really eye-opening.
Rachel then was taking her master's in a school in Philadelphia, where she met her now husband. After graduation, they decided together they were going to head up to the Big Apple and live that New York City dream and pursue art. Looking back, what was it that drew you to New York? Was it that idea that New York is where the art is, that's where you need to be if you want to become an artist? Because I know a lot of people feel that way, especially before the internet.
So in Philadelphia, my master's program was quite different. It was more of like a conceptual program. So it really combined a lot of like theory and philosophy. And then it was more like critiques, and they had a rotating lecture schedule. It was so different than the sort of traditional background I had in my undergrad. And, you know, that was the first time I realized, I think, New York was even a thing, an art scene, because somehow I don't think I realized how much of an art mecca that place was. And Philadelphia is just like an hour bus ride from New York. So I was in New York a lot, seeing the art there. And then Philadelphia has great art too. And our visiting lecture series was amazing. We had like Paul Pfeiffer or Eric Fischel or Chuck Close or, you know, Coco Fusco, like Jeff Koons, like all these people came through. So it was just very different, where in my undergrad, I don't think I remember a single visiting lecturer, you know, like it was just sort of so the opposite that these two programs. I had met my husband in Philadelphia. He was in my program too. He was an artist as well. And I think we both, after school, I was like, I don't really want to stay in Philadelphia anymore. And we were looking where we might move, and we decided to give New York City a go.
So moving up there must have been nerve-wracking. What was that experience like for you? You come from a small farming town. What was it like moving to the concrete jungle?
I don't even know what I was expecting, but we were like really poor when we moved to New York. And we had just left Philadelphia. And I think there was like a bed bug incident in our whole like apartment complex. So we just were like, we really didn't have any furniture to begin with, but I think we had a mattress, and we were just like, well, I don't think it's worth it. So we just moved to New York with like no furniture and just our art supplies and clothes, I guess. And I remember our first apartment that we stayed at, it was like, we got so excited when we finally like went to IKEA and bought like pillows. It was, we had like a cardboard box as a table with like a blanket thrown over it, you know. So the first year was very dicey, you know. It was like all our money was being put towards rent and groceries. And I was working, like we were working all sorts of different odd-end jobs, like installation. I made some custom-made artwork for this company. But eventually I got a job as a professional printmaker and eventually started managing a department for this printmaking company. And it's a very different type of printmaking company. I don't know how to put this. So I would make like the first Colgate box or maybe the first Captain Morgan's label for a jar of alcohol. It was the printmaking process we used is called direct imaging, and it imitates any type of press that's out there, and you can print on any type of material. So it could mimic silkscreen or litho or whatever the industrial process is. So people would come to us to work out their designs. Anyway, so once I had that job, going back, things were much better. You know, we had a bed and, you know, regular income. So it worked out.
Hearing Rachel talk about her and her husband's life, I can relate to that struggle. The struggle you go through when both of you are chasing your dreams and supporting one another as a team along the way. I think that's very important and pretty amazing when you're able to do that. So going from having those nice school studios then to being in New York where there's not a lot of space, what did you do for making your art? Where did you make your art at?
Yeah, it was definitely a shift because I had a studio and then we had, you know, a really tiny apartment and I just could only work on a table. I was working quite differently then than the work I do now. You wouldn't recognize it to what I'm making now. I was working in fabric and layering these fabric pieces and doing kind of these abstract, figurative, minimal pieces. But yeah, I mean, we were young, we were in our 20s, so we were just excited. There's kind of just an energy you run on. You know, there's New York has an amazing vibe and energy to it. And being young there, it was the perfect place to be. It's like everyone you meet, an artist of some sort or a creative type, or at least it felt that way at the time. So you're just butting up against a lot of people that have similar things and you're seeing great things. And, you know, you have your one beer and you're so excited. Yeah, I don't know. There was just a lot to do. I mean, it was never ending. You could stay up all night and find all sorts of stuff to get into.
And by word of mouth, her art started to take off a bit.
At that point, I was just making stuff. And then I got contacted by a gallery in Montreal, and they wanted to represent me. They had seen my artwork, which was great. They offered me a solo show. And so my first big solo show was in Montreal at this gallery called Bata. And I think they just found me because another artist that was there recommended my work.
And how did you feel doing that very first solo exhibition?
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. You know, because they gave me plenty of notice. So I had like a whole year to make like a body of artwork. And, you know, they were really wonderful. When I came to Montreal, they had like an apartment to put us up in. And we could just go there by train. And I don't know, it was just a really great experience. Really great at selling my work too, which is a bonus. Although, unfortunately, I realize this now, but when you're young, you're really excited. They didn't really tell me who my collectors were. So I think that there's a lot, many years of artwork or solo shows I've had that I have no idea where my artwork ended up at.
And during this time, what exactly were you doing to get your art out there in those days?
I guess just through the gallery and word of mouth. Honestly, I didn't start any social media thing. I didn't even have a website. I think this was 2005 or 2006. So yeah, I think around that time I made my first website. And then, but you know, me being from I don't know, very connected to my surroundings and the people I know. I just did not want to be on social media. And I think I really resisted it until, honestly, the pandemic years was the first time I ever even actively posted. And I kind of, my hand was forced. I think my husband opened an account in my name. And it was because two of my galleries decided to close at that point. So he was like, you need to start getting your work out there. And now that I'm in that world, I'm like, oh, shit, I should have been doing this a long time ago.
Rachel kept her day job, even though she was selling art and was using her free time to further pursue her art career. Her art had always been very time consuming, sometimes even taking months to create one work. So it was pretty hard to transfer that into a full-time life as an artist. Soon, though, they decided to start a family and knew they didn't want to stay in New York City. Luckily, when the artist her husband was working for heard they were moving to LA, he decided to move as well.
So I moved out LA with the intention, like I said, my job, I used a lot of chemicals and I couldn't really imagine raising kids in New York and we wanted to have kids. So we moved out to LA with the intention of starting a family. And when I first got there, I was able to get a job using my chemistry and biology background. So I was writing NIH grants for this professor at UCLA for their chemistry biology interface training program. So I was doing that and still making the artwork for, you know, my various shows that I have lined up. And then my husband was working for the same artist in LA and we just had our family and we have two kids now, and that was definitely a big change. I got a lot less sleep for probably the first 6 years or 5 years of their life. It was it was an intense time because I didn't want to sacrifice anything. You know, I would be tired as a dog at night, and I would just, you know, put in the studio time because I knew if I didn't, like, consistently every day at any free moment I got, that it just wouldn't happen.
Then, after having her own children, this increased her desire to teach others, especially the younger generation.
Having kids really changed my perspective too with different areas of art that I wanted to pursue. So I got into early childhood education. How I decided to do that, I guess I was taking my kids to these kind of like play group things where they might do songs and an activity. And then like an art activity. And the things that they offer the kids were like, okay, today we're singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. There's this chicken cutout and you can glue like feathers or a googly eye on it and decorate it with marker or something. And you're like, okay. But then I would watch the parents and see how they interacted with their kids. And it was so much like, these are like 2 and 3 year old kids. And they would be like, you're doing it wrong. The eye goes here. And like, you're like, who cares what they're doing? Just let them, like, it's already so rigid and structured, you know, it has nothing to do with expression. Just let them put the googly eye wherever. And so I kind of got curious. I was like, this isn't a way to teach kids. And I was also teaching college age students at this time, like drawing, you know, at like colleges or universities. And like, I really loved teaching intro to drawing and I couldn't get like some of the students to even hold their pencil differently than a writing utensil. Everyone was so scared to like be adventurous or try things. And so I was spending so much time with that. And then I was like looking at my own kid and watching how parents were interacting with their children. And I'm like, this starts so young. You're just being told no. You can't do things this way. And there's a proper way to do it. Then you get these kids in art classes when they're, I don't know, 18, and it's hard for them to move. So after I studied, I was able to get a job at one of these schools and be like an artillerista and teach art the way I thought it should be taught, I guess you could say. So, I mean, while I was in LA, even then, I was like doing my art career, like the exhibiting and selling artwork, but I was also teaching.
And how was the teaching for you? Did you enjoy it as much as you hoped you would?
I loved it. Yeah, no, I loved it. I mean, I love that job so much. I mean, it's just amazing, like how enthusiastic, you know, kids are. And like, for example, like we had a group of 4-year-olds and, you know, they were really interested in the times of day. So I was like, okay, why don't we learn how to mix color? And then they were mixing, you know, we'd look at a painting and like we'd have a day group and we mix the colors of the day from like photographs they'd taken from around during the day. And then their families brought in photographs of the nighttime. And you'd have these great conversations with them. Like you talk to a kid and they'd be like, I've never seen the moon at night before. And you're like, what? And we're like mixing these colors. And then by the end of it, it's like we had these beautiful palettes. And, you know, we got into discussions of like, how would you show like a whole day? And the kids like mixed colors from like sunrise to midday to sunset, you know? So it was just like so much fun. I don't know, just be there with the kids and explore whatever they were thinking about through art materials.
They stayed in LA for a while, but then the pandemic hit. Her husband's job took them all the way across the pond, this time to the UK.
I guess we moved here 3 years ago. So, but at some point in the pandemic, I think his employer was like, his wife has some family here in the UK. And he was like, I think they got kind of like what everybody got, a little crazy during the pandemic and like needed a change, needed to like escape the city or something. So he's like, we're moving to the UK, but he's like, I don't want to like hang you out to dry without a job. If you'd like, I can still employ you here in the UK. And so at the time too, we were in like a little town home, you know, all shuttered in, or like a little apartment type place. And I think we were just thinking it'd be a great opportunity for our kids because we're kind of more in the countryside here in the UK, like an hour outside of London. And there was just, it's really beautiful and you can just let your kids out the door.
You've moved from Indiana, Philadelphia, New York, LA. Did you miss LA? Did you miss these places at all?
I think I've missed almost everywhere I lived. But for family life, you know what I mean? It's much easier. Where we lived in LA, it's like my child's school, it had like 800 children. And here, his entire school has 100 children. So they have like mixed age classes and it's very familial. Everyone knows everybody else, but it's really great. And we also had like a whole bunch of incidences in a row in LA. Like our house was like broken into. And then like I found like a loaded handgun in our play park right by our place with my kids. And I was like, oh, well, thank goodness I found this and not some other kid. And then I also like at the workplace I was working at, the Child Development Center, it's like we had like some shooter on campus incidences because it was part of a community college. So I was like, maybe it's not so bad to like get to a different neighborhood. And, you know, it just felt like maybe it might be a little better opportunity for my kids, to be honest.
During these years of moving around from New York to LA, then LA to the UK, Rachel's work was evolving throughout that time period, going from portrait style works to more landscapes. Now, if you scroll through her social media or her website, you will see highly detailed drawings of these leafless trees that present a haunting beauty. Once we start to discuss these works, all the pieces of Rachel's past come together to form a more profound picture than I ever expected.
It's funny because I do think when I started moving from city to city, I wasn't doing landscape at all. I was doing like figurative work. And I'm sure that has something to do with just being around people and like thinking more about how people treat each other or these sorts of things. And I think I started coming back to landscape when I started kind of escaping the city for like little trips to like, you know, visit my sisters or go to an arboretum or something. And I think when I went to Yellowstone was the first time I was like, I think I want to delve into landscape. I guess when I moved to LA, I was full into doing landscape at the time. And I feel like Los Angeles is a great town to have easy access to this beautiful nature. Like California is like, just has so many wondrous places. And so do the surrounding states, you know? So that we did lots of road trips. And when I first moved to LA, I was like a transplant there. And I noticed these like Moreton Bay fig trees, which are these really giant trees that are from like a subtropical region in Australia. And they have these giant buttressed roots that grow really huge and above the ground. And they were actually like transplants to LA at the time too. So I think I started going around LA photographing these trees, and I based a whole body of work, I think, on those trees, and it just felt like a way to search for home.
It's through her pen that these images locked inside of her brain flow out onto the paper. These images of not just what her home forest could become, but what all forests on the earth could become.
I think now my landscape kind of continues from that, in the sense that everywhere I draw is based upon a real location. And so it's a place that I've connected with deeply. So whether it be my home forest or these city trees, or, you know, like my last body of work was about these bristlecone pines, which was an ancient pine forest in the Eastern Sierras in California. And they're the oldest living organisms on Earth. Some of them are like older than the pyramids. And I was like visiting these places, and I think my hometown forest is always like a memory of that place that affects my lens of how I see anywhere I go. I was seeing this like these ancient and surreal places. And then going home to my, like visiting my family or something, and going to my old home forests, which were changing drastically. You know, there were so many trees that were dead or dying. And there was new growth, but there was a lot of drought and a lot of insect famines. And, you know, I just started thinking about, you know, what sort of some futuristic landscape might look like. So a lot of my work recently has dealt with the idea of me wandering in the future looking for home through this, like, landscape that's kind of maybe on the borderline of, you know, it's alive with all these roots and stuff, but there's like no leaves. I don't know.
These works, with their high detail and often large scale, transport you to her world. While she is searching for that connection to her home is in part all the places she has been, and even more importantly, her family.
It's funny because I think my family is home, you know, my kids and my husband and those things, but there is, like I said, that pull of my home forest, I just spent so much time there. You know, it's like playing under roots and like the texture detail of just everything, you know, like staring at an inch of grass and just getting to know it so well. I don't know, like home as a place. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, the UK for me right now still doesn't quite feel like home. I still feel like I miss America a little too much. But then I'm like, LA seems like home now that I'm away from it. You know, where like before when I was in LA, it's like almost like the last place I lived feels more like home. So who knows? I don't know.
But trees have an even deeper connection to Rachel because, well, one saved her life.
I even had a tree save my life one time.
What happened with that?
Oh, well, this was when I was quite little. So like I mentioned before, I didn't have a lot of adult supervision. It was kind of like just stay behind the house and not in front of the house. So the second like my mother lets me out the door, I'm like, I'm gonna go to the front of the house by the road. I think at the time I was pretty young, because I remember the door handle of the door being like above me, so I couldn't have, maybe I was just like 4 years old or something, or five. But I went and I was like playing under this like massive like maple tree, and I heard like a bunch of screeching sounds, and then I like looked up and I saw like this car swerving all over the road, and it crashed into the tree that I was playing under. So if I had been on like the other side of the tree, it would have hit me, but the tree was between me and the car. And so the car hit the tree, and I remember like a guy like opening a door, and he stumbled out, and I was like, oh shit. And I like ran into the house. And I ran in through my front door. And when I ran in through my front door, I was like, oh no, my mother's going to know that I was in the front yard. But I told her what happened, and she just didn't say a thing. She walked to the phone and like called the police, and the police showed up, and she still hadn't talked to me. And the policeman, I see her talking to the policeman, and then the police guy comes over to me, and he's like, okay, tell me, I forget. He's like, what happened? And I was like, I just started crying. And I was like, I'm sorry. I'll listen to my mother. Like, don't take me away. I don't know why I thought she called the police on me. And then he's like, I just remember him being like, what? And then he's like, no, what did you see? And I told him what I saw. And I remember the guy being arrested. And my mother was just like, oh, he was a drunk and you got lucky this time. And then she went in the door and I was like, okay, I guess I'm not in trouble. But it was so strange.
I mean, what a traumatic experience. If that was me, who knows how long it would take me until I felt comfortable playing in the front of my yard. But according to Rachel, she was pretty much out popping tar bubbles on the road the very next day. From a tree saving her life, to the forest being where she spent most of her time growing up, it all brings in a new perspective of her art. They're not just beautiful drawings, but they are her heart and her soul applied to the paper by the ink of her pen. She let her heart guide her to leaving chemistry, to making art. She then used her heart to guide her to teaching the youth, and now her heart has guided her to making some extremely personal works of art. Nowadays, between having a family and taking forever to make each work for her various group shows and solo shows, Rachel is beyond busy. And with her journey still being in the early stages, it's very clear she has an important story to tell and a mark to leave on this world. So what are you working on now? Kind of what's your plan for the art?
I mean, I guess, yeah, as a plan, it's always maybe to grow as an artist. So I think right now I keep scheduling like little group shows, and then I also have the solo shows. I think it'd be nice to build up to having multiple solo shows a year, if I could ever swing that. And then maybe things would be cool. But I've also been, dabbling in like digital art and doing stuff there as well. It'd be wonderful to like maybe teach again, but I feel like I don't have time for it at the moment. So like there's so many deadlines and so many things lined up. It's like all I can do is just try to make the work at the moment. But I really miss teaching. So that'd be like great to get back into that at some point.
I hope any young artist listening to this can learn to let their heart be their own guide and not be afraid to get personal with their artworks. It can be tough to put that out on display, but it's that kind of art that we need in this world, and it's that kind of art that brings us together. Well, whoever has made it here to the end of the episode, thank you so much. Thank you everyone who listens to these episodes, and I hope you listen to all the rest. I've been getting a lot of kind messages as of late of people being inspired by the show, and I can't express to you how touched I am. I always wanted this podcast to inspire and motivate people, and to hear from all of you how much it helps really shows me I'm doing the right thing, and all the time and effort is worth it. If you enjoy the show and want to help me continue, consider leaving a review on Spotify or Apple, or maybe a comment on YouTube, and tell everyone you know to come listen. If that isn't enough support, you can also go purchase limited edition art prints on our website from previous guests and other art friends. Me and Rachel are working on a print as we speak, which will be coming out soon. So if you're interested in that, sign up for the Meyer Digital emailing list. Thank you, and I'll see you in the next episode.